Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 25 of Filthy Lip Out in association with Moto Caddy, the world's biggest selling golf trolley brand. And we've got another fantastic guest for you this week, joining us all the way from America, from Austin, Texas, the legendary 2002 PGA champion, Sky Sports pundit, you know and love, Rich Beam, everybody.
Woo!
Rich, thank you for coming on. It's very early over there in America. How are things this morning?
Yeah, everything's good, man. It's 7 o'clock over here. I'm already bright and bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I got a little puppy about. I got him on Masters Monday, and he woke up at 4:45, needing to go outside and take a leak. So my wife went out last night with her friends, so it was my time to do it, and took him out there, and I've been playing chase and tag and fetch and everything with him for the last couple of hours. So I'm wide awake. There's no doubt. In fact, I'm going to get a nap here soon.
That's amazing. Well, my girlfriend and I are thinking about getting a puppy. I know John's got a couple of dogs he loves. We could spend the next hour easily talking about dogs and puppies.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt.
We might lose some dogs, but we'd have a great time.
Dogs are a lot more fun to talk about than boring old golf most days, I can tell you that.
But tell you, on a quick note then, on the back of dogs, because how good are they for your health? I seen Rich the other day. You put out a little Instagram live about mental health. And,
yeah.
You had your mates in a bar, and you had you had the scary dude at the end. He wasn't that scary. He was just a big fella, man.
Oh God, he's a mountain of a man. Yeah, he played 1 year at the NFL, played at Louisiana. But yeah, I had a friend of mine take his life earlier this year, back Monday after the U.S. Open. And this was a gentleman that I came home after when I would come home off the road, whether I was playing or I was working for Sky, he would be probably one of three people that I would see, that day, between my wife and two kids. And then more than likely him, I would make an effort to get into the gym, if nothing else, to walk in and say hi to him, and amongst other things, as you do. But somebody I spent, since I've been in Austin, Texas, I worked out with him for about 14 years and he just, there's a lot of things that came up to it and whatnot. And, he was an athlete. He was a trainer, obviously, but he was an athlete as well. Baseball player, cowboy, did all of it, but something happened and he just felt like he couldn't handle it anymore. And it's, I think that if you live this life long enough, you're going to find somebody in your life that does this, that takes their life. And yeah. I don't want to say there's no reason or an excuse for it, but I think there's a way to help prevent it. And I think that a lot of the cool things, John, that we've been talking about as men as of late, getting out on the golf course and having 4.5 hours with your buddies, being able to vent, being able to get somebody else to listen, because it's not that easy chatting. Andrew Johnston was the first golfer that I really know that came out and said something. And I know that I struggled with some things when I was playing. You just, as I don't even say just as men, but as individuals, we build things up in our life that we feel that are so substantial, we can't get past them. Yeah. And yet, here's the cool thing about this. I've got one of these, right? I got an iPhone. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got a phone. If you can't go into that phone and pick out five people that you can call at any given part of the day and say, I'm in trouble, I need you.
Yeah.
And if they don't come running, then you might need to find some new friends. But I think everybody's got five people on their phone. If they don't have five, they've got three.
Yeah.
Pick up the phone, call someone, tell them that you're not feeling good. So my goal is I'm still trying to work on, I'm still trying to figure this all out, because it's hard exactly what direction you want to go with. And I think what I'm going to go with is more kind of the athlete. I think the athletes for me, because it kind of resonates. I spend a lot of my time around professional golfers, and then obviously you get to meet other athletes from other sports. What we're going through is not mutually exclusive. I think every single athlete at some point goes through this, and how do they get through it? I've known some athletes, not known them personally, but I've watched athletes, take their own lives in other sports. And I think it's a way to kind of say, listen, we're no different, even though, you know, you, in American football, you put on these pads and you strap it on, you go and you get running as fast as you can into a guy that weighs 300 pounds. You know, that makes you tough. That makes you big and burly. That makes you strong. Yeah. But listen, it may not make you strong mentally. Right. So yeah, same thing with rugby, same thing with your football over there. I mean, guys struggle. You can't see it. You think the fame, the fortune, the legions of fans, this and that, blah, blah, blah. But listen, when those lights turn off and everybody goes home, you go home to a different world where it's not like that. So I'm just trying to figure out a way to bring more light to it. I know my good buddy and you know, Pat Perez fairly well. He's yeah. involved with it. So I'm trying to get together with Pat and some other folks and trying to get something started, because I think it needs to happen. I think that we've talked about it a little bit and Andrew Johnson started it, you know, in my mind's eye, but I think it's time that a tournament was started, you know, anything to just raise as much awareness as possible. And I can't think of a better way than through sports. I think that sports is, at least in the United States and over there as well, sports is everything. You know, why do you and your mates get together and go to the pubs? Why do you, you know, what do you guys talk about for hours?
Exactly.
I mean, that's what it is. And so I'm just trying to figure out the best way to do it still, John, you know, and I come up with some great ideas after a few libations, but it's certainly on the top of my list of things that I got to do, but I'm going to get some friends involved that really kind of know what they're doing to help organize a tournament for me. And whether or not I have in Louisiana, we'll see, but I it's going to be somewhere here. That's fairly close to me and what we can do, but yeah, thanks for asking about that, because it is a big deal, you know, and it's tough. Like I said, I think that at some moment in time, somebody that you are close to or somebody that you've worked alongside,
yeah,
or somebody that, you know, you just don't want to see that happen, you know, and we could do the whole show about this, about feelings about it and whatnot, but thanks for asking. We're going to figure out a way to do it in 2021. And I don't know how it's all going to get put together, but I've had a lot of people on social media reach out to me and wanting to help out. And that tells me that there's a need and a want for it. And no matter how big or small it is or how, whatever the case is, at least we're going to bring some awareness to it in 2021 and see what we can do.
Well, I'll put it out there quickly for you, Beamer. What is it? The Out of Bounds podcast, which is run by Michael Collins and Pat Perez. You know, I just listened to them this morning, actually, and they had someone come on where a friend had, you know, taken his own life, and Pat had come out with a great scenario saying about, you know, he obviously runs a lot of different tournaments and does different other things to help different other charities and other things like that. And he says he's going to try and do something for them. So I reckon that'd be a good angle for you to go down with Pat and Michael, because it seems like they got their foot in the door and want to do something as well. So go for it, buddy.
Exactly. I talked to Pat a little bit about this a couple of weeks ago, and he and I are on the same page. It's, you know, we've talked yeah. about it. And I think the thing is about it is that you kind of help out. I think every golfer does this. You help out your buddy here. You help out your buddy there. You donate some time to this tournament. You donate some time to that event, that cause, whatever it is. Now it's kind of time for me to, I think, it sounds like Pat wants to do it as well with the help of Mike Collins, who's great. Do it yeah. ourselves. Do something ourselves and make it our own fun, because I know that there's some guys that do some great charity work on the PGA Tour already. Jim Furyk comes to mind. Ernie Els comes to mind. And that's right. just scratching the surface. But I think now with Pat Perez, I think we can do something a little bit different. Mm. And I think it'll bring a massive benefit to a lot of folks.
Good man. Beamer, good man.
Great sentiment. Thanks, especially this year as well, in 2020, when we've been through so much and so many people have been on their own through lockdowns and isolations and not being able to see friends and family as much as they might do. It does feel like there's real momentum growing for the conversation and for just the barriers are being broken down, because, you know, as men, often we hide those feelings and we don't talk as much as we should. And anything that can help towards that and encourage people just to share their feelings, if you need to reach out to someone, have a chat, anything like that is going to help.
The interesting thing about the side note to all of what has been going on, that I think that we forget to ask, is what is it doing to people's personal lives, having to stay home? They're talking about, you know, keeping you alive and keeping you safe. But I can promise you that there's a lot of people that have been decimated, devastated financially, which then turns into personal issues. And, you know, I look at my friend taking his life. His business was in shambles, and I don't think he felt he had another way. He had, you know, he just didn't have the wherewithal mentally to get past it all. I mean, there's so many things that were weighing him down, and having the government tell you to stay home and not go out and not socialize and not do things, and you have to close your business, you have to do that. I mean, listen, I'm not saying that not staying home was would have been the ideal situation either. I mean, COVID has decimated so many people in so many different ways. I think we can't just look at the raw numbers and say that, well, because of this, we've had this person died by COVID, because I can promise you my friend's life, who he took, that's not going to be a COVID stat, but it sure as shit was. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry, but it was.
Hell shit. Yeah.
And so, I mean, how many folks do you have? I mean, I know I've been keeping up with everything in the UK as well, guys. And, you know, the folks that have to stay at home, you know, the domestic violence, there's so many things that can happen. It's, you know, I don't want to get too depressed right now. But still, it's one of those things though that needs to be looked at in a different way. And what is the effect? Because we're a society that needs to see people. We're a society that needs to go out and needs to shake our friends' hands, give hugs, you know, give kiss. I mean, we need the social interaction. We truly do. And for that to be taken away, you know, you have so many different levels of people that can do it. I mean, if you're the Kardashians, you're not suffering by having to stay at home, right? Mm-hmm. You have a plenty of distractions, right? But if you live in a one bedroom flat and you have 600 square feet as your own personal roaming space, and you have, you know, people that live with you, you don't have freedom. You're living on top of each other. It's not the same. No, so true. That's.
I mean, this whole year, it really feels like you're treading a tightrope in terms of whichever way you turn in terms of making decisions. And there's no right answer, but hopefully with the vaccine now, I know we've started rolling it out over here in the UK. It started to go out, I think, in the US as well now. That's hopefully some light at the end of the tunnel. To bring things up a little bit, so we've got deep there early on. But
I forgot my Christmas hat. Come on.
We've covered too deep, but some important stuff early on.
Well, I appreciate you guys talking about that, because I think it was important, but that was good shit. So we can move on.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. The more we can talk about things like that, the more it becomes accepted, the more everyone can. And it's a journey that society needs to go through to have these conversations and to feel comfortable doing it, and that they are worthwhile to have, and they 100% are. To get back to the, well, less important stuff, I guess, in many ways, which is the golf. Rich, obviously most people know you as 2002 PGA champion. But I want to go back actually to a couple of weeks before that, because you won 2 weeks prior at the International. And I was just going back through how that tournament ended just before jumping on here, watching it.
Such a good event, man. It was such a good event.
An insane finish. Battle between you and Steve Lowry. I mean, there were eagles, albatrosses, birdies, balls getting played out of the water in those final few holes. Obviously, you win that event and then go on to win the PGA 2 weeks later. What are your recollections of the finish at the International in general, and then how that set you up to get your major victory a fortnight later?
Coming down the stretch at the PGA at the International was mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. We actually had a rain delay. I was in the penultimate group, and then on the 13th hole, we ended up having a rain delay. And I kind of had a dodgy back all week. You know, I was just kind of struggling with just some muscle spasms and whatnot. And the last thing you want to do is to get out of the hot, humid weather and go inside to a cold, air-conditioned room. And I'm kind of thinking to myself, okay, this isn't grand. And so I'm sitting here trying to move around when I get into the locker room and whatnot, keep stretching out, keep the back warm, but it was hard. And when I went back out, it took me about two or three shots to finally feel like, okay, finally we got back out of the heat and humidity, the back is fine again. But I was playing phenomenal golf until the break. And And I missed a short birdie putt on 14, which was kind of the only putt I missed all day. And then when I make eagle on 17, I'm standing on the tee on 18. I've got a 9-point lead with one hole to go. Now, throughout every single year that I'd played, and I was in my fourth year playing there, but every single time you're at that tournament, you're like, man, wouldn't it be great to just pick up your golf ball and walk straight down the 18th fairway, knowing that you're only going to lose 3 points and you got no shot of losing the tournament? Wouldn't that be awesome? And they put a reminder in the locker room. You must do your make a best effort to finish out the tournament. And so they tell you, you've got to continue playing. But I'm sitting there playing with Mark Brooks. I'm thinking to myself, man, I'd pick this ball up and just walk right in. Man, I got a 9-point lead. There ain't no way I'm going to lose this tournament now. Well, little did I know that, you know, I hit a great tee shot down the 18th. Little did I know that Lowry was behind me making everything from everywhere. And then you hear the big roar going up, and I'm walking down the fairway with David Faraday. And I'm like, what happened? You know, I said, did Craig Barlow make three? And he goes, no. I said, well, Steve Lowry make three? And he goes, no. I go, what the hell? He goes, Steve Lowry made two. I go, Lowry made two? Yeah, so my lead's button one. Yeah. And so we're going down the 18. And now, I mean, I'm 9 points ahead, and all of a sudden I'm one before I hit my second shot. I'm going, what in the hell just happened?
Yeah.
So I knock it on the green, make four. And then Lowry hits in there about 10, 12 feet just left of it, putting straight back up the hill, a little bit left to right, or just didn't move on him. And he ends up missing the putt. But I'm sitting there standing above the green on the left hand side going, if he makes it, I lose. If he misses it, I win. And there's no playoff. We're not going to extra holes. Yeah. This is it.
No.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing with the scoring. One or the other.
Because of the scoring, it's the one time in the PGA Tour where a guy's got a putt to make it or a putt to lose.
That's so good. John, you've played that
event as well, haven't you, when you were on the PGA Tour? It's the scoring there, how impressive was that finish from Rich, obviously, and Steve as well? You haven't seen that course.
Well, that course in general, when I first arrived there, I thought it was something like Walt Disney had made it. It would just look different, you know, completely different to what I was used to. And obviously, I was like a fish out of water anyway, being on the PGA Tour my first year. And then getting to play that one in a point system, I just loved it. And all the players turned up. You had Ernie there. You had them all there. You know what I mean? They all wanted to play it. It was amazing. It was somewhat different, refreshing. You could be aggressive. You didn't lose too much ground if you had a bad one. You know, you could make it up with a bit of a flourish of a few good holes, and then you were back in it again. So it was lovely. I really enjoyed it. It's a shame it never lasted.
And you hit the ball a long way too, so that golf ball went forever for you.
Oh, yeah. Well, I played with Hank Keeney, and you remember that first hole, right?
Yeah, par five.
That first hole, he hit driver. Get this, right? I hit driver and a 2-iron on the green. And it's 700 odd yards, isn't it?
Yeah.
The first. Yeah. And I've hit it on the green, and he's at driver lob wedge. Lob wedge. This thing went into orbit, never came down. Obviously, air's thin, tee's way up high. Wham! He's giving it over down the right-hand side, and it's just gone forever. And I was there going, I played with him at Doral that year as well. And, you know, he was 40 past me every time we were playing. So I was like, not surprised, you know, as soon as it was thin and he hit it miles like he did. Jeez Louise.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah, but mate, it was a good year, 2002 anyway, mate, wasn't it? Because I got my card. You won the PGA. Let's talk about that, mate. The PGA. Tiger Woods taking him down.
Man, it feels like forever ago. Forever ago.
Oh man, where is the Wanamaker anyway? Where is it in your house? Is it right by the cabinet?
Yeah, it's downstairs. I'm up on the third floor. The only thing I got up here is let's see, where am I here? I got some stuff there. Those scorecards on the bottom right, that from the winning scorecards. Not just a little memorabilia. Some stuff that folks sent me, but yeah, the trophy is downstairs. Just, you know what? Funny enough, it's tarnished bad. I gotta pull it down and clean it before my in-laws get here for Christmas. It's not silver, it's more like just a dirty brown. I'm bad about keeping it clean.
Trophies that get neglected,
it's horrible, you know, between that and the international trophy. Funny enough, the international trophies, John's seen it, I mean, it's massive. I mean, it's a big trophy. And it weighs, because the base of it, I think, is made out of oak. I mean, it weighs like 50 pounds. And they sit there and they say, well, this is going to be heavy when you pick it up. I'm like, dude, I'm on cloud nine. It'll not be a big deal. They hand it to me. I'm like, holy cow. I mean, the base of it was just, you know, and it's massive. I mean, this trophy is huge. But yeah. The one they send you is like this. It looks like a little ashtray, you know. It looks like you take the top off, just flick your ashes in there, you know. It's pretty bizarre how big the real one is and how small the other one is. That needs some cleansing too.
So what was that like then, Rich, when you won the international, momentum wise, if you can tell any hints of anyone, you know, ride the train, as they say, keep riding it. You know, what was the momentum like going into the PGA, which was 2 weeks later? What was that like?
You know, I was playing well all year up to that point, I thought, John. And I actually, funny enough, I added the John Deere. I was supposed to take 2 weeks off in the middle of summertime, and I just called up my caddy on Friday. I said, listen, you don't have to go, but I'm going to commit to the John Deere. I said, I just feel like, you know, something good's about to happen. I feel like we're playing well. I feel like we get, you know, we got some momentum. I don't want to be, you know, taking time off and doing that. So I ended up adding the John Deere and going out. We played late, early. I shot 67. I shot like 67, 75 or some shit. I'm just like, what the hell just happened? I mean, and the game is easy. So we sprint to the airport, catch the last flight out to Denver that night and get up to Denver late that week. But, you know, obviously, when you have momentum and you're playing well, things seem to be fairly easy. Yeah. And we played Hazeltine. We were the first out on Monday morning, just my caddy and I, because he got up. I had to get up there on Saturday to do something on Sunday for one of my sponsors. And then so he came up same time. And we played first thing Monday. And it's just like – you know how you get, you know, John, you remember playing all these new golf courses on the PGA Tour, you know, they're all different. They seem something about them is quirky, things like that. Well, there wasn't anything quirky about Hazeltine for me. And that was very bizarre because that's one of those things where I hadn't played in, but that was my fourth major. And you just, every time you get to a major, it always feels like there's something quirky about it. There's something that you got to try and figure out, whether it's the greens, whether it's the lines off the tee, you name it. There's always something funny about it that it's hard to wrap your head around. Yeah. Well, there wasn't anything like that at Hazeltine for me. It's like once I saw it, it's like, okay, this is a pretty basic golf course. There's a couple of tough driving holes for me, but for the most part, there was enough movement in the fairways that it almost made it easier because it kind of said, okay, you got to hit a fade here. Okay. You got to hit a draw here. You got to move it off this bunker. There was something about it. And there wasn't that much to the greens that I found to be very bizarre. So we played Monday, Tuesday, and then went out to go practice on Wednesday. And we weren't even out there for an hour. And my caddy goes, what do you think? I said, I don't know why we're out here. I'm wasting my time. I'm wasting your time. Let's go do something else. He goes, all right. So he took off, went and played golf across town. I went with my wife and we went and hung out and had lunch. I think we went and saw a movie or something, but I mean, it was just one of those things where everybody talks about putting the time in on the driving range and all that. I didn't need to do that. I mean, I played two practice rounds, got some time in, but I felt like I knew the speed of the greens as good as anybody else. And obviously I did because I putted the best that week, but it wasn't just the greens. It was a whole golf course. And I think that's what was so fun for me. Was that I didn't have to sit there and stress about – I had to stress about two tee shots. The tee shot on three was tough for me, and the tee shot on 15 was tough for me. And then other than that, it really wasn't – and funny enough, those were both par fives, so it didn't matter if I drove in the rough. I could still, you know, I could still get it on at three. But still, it was just one of those golf courses that off the tee, it was pretty straightforward. And when I think that if you ask a lot of the players – when they find a golf course they're liking, the first thing they say is off the tee. It felt good off the tee because you need to put the ball in the fairway first and foremost. Yeah. And that's what was so good about Hazeltine for me is that I felt like off the tee, it was going to be a pretty, pretty smooth sailing week.
Well, it's nice when you come to a golf course, when you just naturally feel suits me to the eye. It's nice and relaxing. It's nice and smooth. You know, you do no stresses, no stresses,
no stresses, no stress. I mean, that, and that's just, I think what any golf course you're looking for as a pro, the first time you see it, or when you go back to see it, even if you don't have success there, you still like Riviera. I love the way Riviera looks to me. I mean, everything about it off the tee looks great, even though the greens, the greens kind of scare me, but everything about the golf course to me, I just love. I can see shots happening out there. I always love going back to Riv, even though I didn't always play well there. I couldn't wait to get there, and it sucked leaving. And I enjoyed playing Riv probably more than anything on tour. But, I mean, that's just, you know, what you find, you know, and it's always remarkable to me, John, how you get some guys that show up, seem like every week the golf course suits their eyes. Like, I don't get it, man.
mate, me neither, but times have changed.
You get to the back nine at Hazeltine, and it's that situation that everyone's spoken about until they're blue in the face over the last 20, 25 years. You're there leading a tournament, and Tiger Woods makes his charge. You're in front. What is that like, that feeling? You're the man with the target on your back, and you can see Tiger's coming for you.
Yeah, well, thankfully he was in front of me so I could watch him doing everything. You know, the funny thing, and this is the guys on the street that I've told this, you know, at least I'm consistent with this. I wasn't paying attention to what he was doing. I did know at the turn that I was one ahead of him. But then when I eagled 11 and birdied 13, and it's not that I wasn't looking at leaderboards, because I was, but it's not that I just wanted to see where, you know, where I was. But when I made the putt on 13 for birdie, I didn't realize that he had three putted it from nowhere. And all of a sudden I look up right on my line, my through line, there's a leaderboard, and I saw myself, I'm 10 under. Now it gets interesting. Now, you know, the only way you're going to lose this thing is if you start doing something stupid and you start fumbling and throwing up on your foot joints, right? So thankfully I had about a 75 yard walk to the next tee, and I was able to kind of slow myself down just a little bit. But, you know, my caddy was fantastic in that situation. He's still my closest friend, and he just kept everything pretty low key. But even when Tiger was going on that run, you know, for me, it didn't matter, because I kind of felt like, listen, the only way I'm going to lose this thing is if I screw up. And thankfully he ran out of holes and I didn't screw it up, you know, but, you know, and I heard the roars, and he was playing with Fred Funk. So every once in a while I'd say, way to go, Fred, you know, because he was a great story that week. And I knew, of course, the roars weren't for Fred, but still you kind of hope maybe one of them was. But yeah, watching the replays of where Tiger was making birdies for him and all that was pretty, remarkable. But, you know, to be fair, like I said, I had such a big lead with five holes to go that the only thing that was going to happen was if I screwed it up. So, I mean, he took a step backwards on that back nine for a few holes, and that's what put him behind the eight ball and whatnot. But, you know, that's just the way it goes. You know, I mean, I played good to just, you know, to open up the back nine, and he didn't. And that was the difference.
I mean, you birdied 16, which gave you the two-shot lead going into 17, 18.
Oh, I had like a four-stroke lead still after I birdied 16, because he birdied 17 and birdied 18, and I bogeyed 18. So I had a three, yeah.
How much more comfortable did that enable you to play those last few holes in what would be considered a relaxed manner, considering you're playing for a major championship on Sunday afternoon? Did it take the pressure off?
Oh God, no!
Was it more?
No,
you didn't want to.
No.
Does that make it worse almost? That you're like,
here's the thing, and this, and I don't know how John feels about this, because he's, you know, to get to where he does on the PGA Tour, but you get to a point where you can't get any more nervous than what you've been at a certain point in life, right? Like, you know that this is what's going to happen, and you're going to get so nervous that this is where your body and mind are going to take you, and it's how you deal with it. Now, it's not that you get any more nervous or any less nervous. You still get the same amount of nervous. It's just, how do you handle it? How do you go about it? So I was still just as nervous. I mean, I think because it's probably more because it's the finality of it. It's not the fact that you have a four-stroke lead with two to go and you think you can screw it up. It's more about the finality of it. You have to still finish it off. It's still, you know, you're not going to give you – they're not going to give you the trophy after 16 holes because you get four up with two to go. That's just not going to happen. You still have to get across that checkered line in first place, you know. So and it's not that you felt like you was going to screw anything up either. It's just that you got to do it. You've got to finish it off. And that's what makes Tiger such a phenomenal individual, is that he always ran through the 72nd hole, where some guys run to the 68th hole.
Yeah.
And then they forget about the last three. You know, they just – and Tiger didn't do that. He always sprinted through the 72nd hole. And then once he got through that, then he stopped to stop, you know, start breathing and take you know, note of where he was. But there's guys that, that couldn't do that. And so I think that's the one thing that makes it hard, is that you do have to continue to finish. You have to play those last two holes. And so it doesn't make it a whole lot easier, even though you have a four-stroke lead. Now, it doesn't suck in saying that. I'd rather have a four-stroke lead than being four back. But it definitely the nerves were definitely still there, my friend.
How much did your life change overnight with that win?
Oh, I tell you what, I got a lot taller, a lot better looking. Yeah. I was much smarter. You know, it was definitely I definitely had the goods then. I felt like James Bond for the first time in my life when I walked into a
definitely
Beam, Rich Beam. no, I, you know, and it's funny because I truly did feel like that. I felt like, you know, people were asking me questions, like they were expecting to hear some sort of epiphany on, on how it became that I was the first guy to ever take down Tiger Woods in a major. And it's just like, guys, man, it's just golf. Yeah. I was the first, but I won't be the last. I can promise you that. And, you know, but it was definitely strange. There's no doubt. I mean, our morning show, their big morning show over here, was the Today Show. I went on that. I was asked to go on David Letterman's show. You would know David Letterman.
Oh, yeah.
I was asked to go on the David Letterman show, and I didn't do it because we were on the West Coast and he's on the East Coast. And I'm just like, oh, my God, of all the things that I should have done, I should have gone on the Letterman show.
You definitely should have gone on the Letterman show.
I know, and I don't know. And I didn't because I just was thinking, no, I need to be here and I'm competing. And to be fair, I played well that week. But, I mean, come on, you only get to be on David Letterman once in your life. And so I didn't. I blew it from that standpoint. But no, the aftermath was fantastic. You know, got no sleep on Sunday night, as you can well imagine. And then my buddy comes over that lives in Seattle. That morning we go out for breakfast and whatnot. And after breakfast, he and I are going to go out and go have some fun, go look at some exotic cars and this and that. And my wife says, do me a favor. I go, what's that? She goes, buy anything you want. I go, oh God, yes. You know, and I ended up not buying anything. I ended up not getting anything, you know. It was funny because I walked into this high-end store, because when I was working up in Seattle at the time, selling car phones and cell phones and car stereos, I, you know, we had these guys that would go buy these really high-end exotic Porsches, Ferraris, things like that from a dealership called Car Toys just down the road from us. And we always kind of joked, wouldn't it be great to go into Car Toys and just buy a car, you know, and just go in there. Well, so we go in there on that Monday, and this is, you know, I walk in there with cargo shorts on, a big hooded sweatshirt, a ball cap, you know, and I probably still smell like Jack Daniels, you know, because it'd been a long night. But we walk in there, and I had to take a phone call from my accountant about something that was, funny enough, unrelated to the PGA money, but I was on the phone with him for about 15 minutes, and then I walked back in, and nobody would help me or look at me. You know, it was really strange. And I kept walking around going, listen, I've got all the money in the world right now, you know, for me anyway. I couldn't freaking buy anything. And so I walked away. It was like, it was disappointing and funny in the same breath, you know, and you know, it was just one of those things, but we damn sure had a good time after the win, but definitely things did change, you know, just things change in a way that I didn't expect in some regards. And the notoriety was good and bad all in the same breath. I have a hard time saying no, as John well knows. And so you said yes a lot to Oh, one more. Oh, come do this. Oh, let's do that, you know. So.
Oh, yeah, exactly. But, mate, you had a good, you could say a little bit shorter than what you would have liked, probably a bit like myself, just, but, mate, you got to go back there, and you made the cut. And, you know, you did it probably with all the odds against you as well. So, you know, what was that like, buddy?
That was fun. Yeah. I mean, I went out and I, it was one of the fun things about that week for me is you go back and you get the champions dinner and the previous year's champion hosts it and Harrington was hosting it. And they just come out with the tee times and I got paired with Harrington and Tiger.
Nice.
And so Harrington asked me to give a little speech. He asked two people to go up there and just say a few words about winning the PGA and this and that. So I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to say? So I walk up and Harrington and Tiger knew that we were all playing together. And I give them my old Ron Burgundy. I said, Tiger, Padraig, I said, I just want you to know that people in this town, they know me. I'm kind of a big deal around here, you know, and it was, and people started laughing, howling, and they, you know, and it was just like, what do you do? What do you say, you know, when you get up there? So I just kind of talked about winning and whatnot, but, you know, getting up there and playing with those guys. And I was a plan burger in 09, to be fair. And to be paired with them the first couple rounds, I always enjoyed being paired with Tiger because it always made me focus that much more. Cause you didn't want to go out there and lay an egg playing golf, you know, with the greatest player of our generation. And I shot one under the first day and I played good. I mean, I grinded it out. I putted good. And then from there, I didn't putt worth a crap, but I mean, made the cut, but it was tough, man, getting out there playing with those guys and not having your A game. And you're just going, Jesus, you know, just please get me through this. And the best thing about that by a long shot is the people that I've met along the way. And I've got a very close friend and family, Patrick and Marilee Hunt, and their two kids, Henry and Maggie. We're the closest of friends. And that's probably the greatest thing that ever came out of winning the PGA up there is getting to know Patrick and Marilee, Maggie and Henry. And we go on vacation with them every year. And that part about it, it's amazing.
Was that when the boys took you out and you had to go into the sea when it was really cold?
That was Patrick. That was Patrick. Yep. That's exactly right. That was Patrick and his son, Henry, and my son, Michael, beat us. So Patrick and I had to walk out into the ocean after playing Pebble Beach the second day because we got smoked 2 days in a row.
You must have come back in with one ball left because it looked like it was cold.
No, listen, they're both in my lungs. I think you can still hear them up there in my lungs. I can't quite talk the same since then.
Mate,
it was so cold. And then we turned the camera off, and then we went back in again with Henry. I couldn't get my son Michael in. He was like, no way. So we went back in there, and we're freaking diving in the ocean we were there for probably about 10 minutes, but oh my God, John, it was so freaking cold, man. But it had to be done though. It had to be done. I mean, we lost a bet fair and square to our boys. They took us out, but we had a great time with it, man. It was so funny. That's the thing. Listen, that's what life is all about, isn't it? Just going out there and having fun. It's about the memories that you create and the funny stories you can tell and the dumb things that you do, in good fun. But that was definitely one of them where you're just like, you know what? We lost. I got to pay up. Let's go. And it was just, oh my God, it was no fun.
So good, man. It was so good.
You likely mentioned there the amount of fun that you obviously have in golf. And I think that comes across in your commentary and your punditry now. And I think that's why so many people enjoy listening to you because you're so knowledgeable, but you're enjoying it. You're having fun. You did the book with Alan Shipnuck as well, Bud Sweat and Tees, about your rookie season on the PGA Tour. Obviously had a good time there as well. What are the anecdotes, the stories, the experiences that stand out for you over the course of your career?
Oh man, there's a lot of different ones. Funny enough, I gave a speech earlier this year in Wentworth, and I probably told him the worst story that I could probably tell him, which it sticks out of my mind because I look back and I think it's funny, but it, you know, when you have guns drawn on a golf course on a Monday morning, it probably is a little bit less funny to the English crowd than it does to the American crowd. Yeah. We think that guns are funny, you know, sometimes, but especially in Texas, nobody got shot. Nobody got anything, but yeah. This guy that was, he was the year before he'd hopped the fence to go hit golf balls in the range at TPC Las Colinas. And he was, he was bipolar and whatnot. And he drove through the front gate, trying to get in the tournament. They tried to hold him back. He drove right through. He drove to the left of the first hole, down the second, all the way down the third, crossed the road over the fourth tee. And I'm thinking, and I see the guy on the fourth tee, and he's driving across, and I'm thinking, okay, he's a vendor. You know, a little vendor tent's out there. I kind of figure, okay, you know, going to Phillips. And then I kind of wondered, like, I've never seen a car out there, you know, and all the years I've been coming to Las Colinas and the Byron Nelson. And he drives over there, and all of a sudden I see two motorcycle cops following him. At, you know, they're not in high speed. They don't have the flashers on. I'm like, okay, this is kind of interesting. Well, he drives down the ninth hole, then turns back around, comes up the sixth, goes up the seventh, and pretty soon there's two more motorcycles, and then there's another – there's a cart with three police officers and a guy by the name of Danny Colson, who is the head of security of the PGA Tour. That's when I knew things were about to get weird, when Danny shows up. So this guy comes barreling down the eighth hole, and all of a sudden you see this golf cart with the three police officers. They all jump out of it. The cart goes flying off to the side, and these guys pull their firearms, and they're pointed right at this car. And all of a sudden I'm thinking, oh, my Lord, this is not a drill. This is real. And finally the guy stops the car. He gets out, and, you know, they throw him to the ground like you see on the TV show Cops, you know, and it's the real deal, right? And so finally, I'm like, this is unbelievable. We're standing there for 10 minutes now watching this. I mean, we're glued. We can't hit a tee shot. I'm like, this is unbelievable. We're going to watch a guy get taken out, right? Thankfully, that didn't happen. Yeah, thankfully, that didn't happen. No damage to the golf course, no nothing. I mean, but the guy didn't lose his life. That's the most important part, right? And it turns out, you know, the guy was bipolar, was off his meds, and just he thought he was a professional golfer, and he obviously wasn't, but he just had this thing in his brain. And I'm telling this story in Wentworth this spring, and I'm sitting here kind of laughing about it, and everybody in the room is mortified. And afterwards I go, maybe that wasn't the best story I could have told him. I probably have a few more that are funnier than that, which I do, of course. But, you know, for whatever reason, I go back to that story as the strangest thing that I've ever seen on a golf course by a long shot. But, yeah, I mean, and here's the thing about my commentary is that I work with the greatest team in TV. And the only reason that my personality comes out is because I'm surrounded by the folks that allow it to come out. I can promise you, if I was on a U.S. network, you wouldn't see the same personality, because it's harder to get it out in how they do TV. And sitting alongside Ewan and Boxy and Radar and Cole Tart, and unfortunately Johnny and I have not worked together enough times, because I think that is by design from our bosses at Sky, because we worked in Switzerland together, but where else did we work?
I still use that hip flask, by the way, man. I still use that hip flask that you bought me.
The Russian one that I got us?
Yeah, man. My dad's got it in there. He won't let me have it back. He loves it.
Oh, my gosh. That place was a lot of fun. But we worked somewhere else together, didn't we, John?
St. Andrews, Dunhill?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Because we went out there and played golf the day before or 2 days before and froze to death out at that other golf course. That's right. Yeah, we need to work more together. But, you know, because of everybody that I work alongside, we all work together. It's just, if you're not having fun or entertained by watching us, you know, entertained by with the laughs and entertained by what we have to say and our knowledge of the game, then you're not quite listening. Because I think that, you know, we provide some of the best commentary out there, because we don't take ourselves too seriously, but we still know what we're talking about. And yeah. I think that you need to have that in the game, because I think that if you don't have that and you're always serious, mm-hmm. you know, then you're missing the point of it all. And I, it just, you got to have that. You got to be entertained.
What was it like, Beamer, with, I mean, you've just come off, I mean, the last major, funny enough, it's always been the first, was the Masters. I mean, how was that? Because that was weird circumstances, mate, from a massive fan of the Masters, watching it with no crowd there was really bizarre. You know, you're seeing these great shots and you know what the patrons would go like. They go absolutely nuts and you're not getting that vibe. I mean, what was it like for you? It must have been pretty surreal because you were out on course, weren't you?
Yeah, it was. I mean, going around there, and I played Augusta a few times, you know, outside of the tournament, so you get a chance to see it without any of the fans and whatnot. But still, to be at the tournament and knowing it's going on, that was really strange. Once again, I always kind of find the funny part of things. And so what they do, instead of having ropes up, they put these green lines, but stripes more or less than anything else, kind of on the side of the fairway, kind of as a, you know, stay outside of those. And they were everywhere around the golf course, but you had a lot more freedom to walk around. I mean, it wasn't as stringent as I kind of thought it might be, but they had those stripes out there for obviously us and the members to not get inside of those and get too close to the action of play. Well, I can promise you in the afternoons after the members had a few libations, but those green stripes meant absolutely nothing. Nothing. The left of 17, and Patrick Cantlay was, I think it might have been Saturday, and to the left 17, and I'm fairly close to the green line, but I'm up probably 30, 40 yards. He's playing well. I watched this member and his wife walk past the green stripes, past the trees. They can't be but two steps off the fairway. Patrick is one step off the fairway. They can't be 20 feet away from Patrick. And it's just he and his wife sitting there, and they've got these little cups with the swizzle sticks in them and having a cocktail. And I'm just sitting there laughing, just going, you know what? Nowhere else would this happen, but yet I find it to be very entertaining because this is their gig. This is their party. This is their tournament. And I love them for it. I think this is fantastic. I thought it was fantastic because, I mean, there was, and that wasn't the only couple. I mean, there was just other people around, but that one was just kind of the one, but there's so many times where the green lines just didn't really matter. And to be fair, it shouldn't have mattered anyways, because they were still far enough away. It was only if they were going to get into the vision of the camera. That's the only thing they didn't want to have. But I mean, it was just so funny to see there was a lot more folks working TV than there were players and even the members and their guests. I mean, it was pretty bizarre, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the fact that you can see a lot more of the golf course without the stands, without a lot of the structures they put up. You could see so much more of the golf course. I thought 15 was phenomenal, the second shot, because you didn't have the stands right or left. I saw a number of guys miss their second shots left and end up in the water just past the tee box on 16. I saw a number of them on the tee box on 16. Really? And then I saw some of the guys halfway between 15 green and 17 fairway, which is pretty close approximation. If you haven't been there, it's hard to kind of describe, but 17 fairway is not too far away from 15 fairway, so guys would be missing it way out to the right. But what it did is it sometimes made it easier because it opened up some more of the angles, because where you wanted to hit some of your shots, because the stands weren't there, because the patrons weren't there, you could really open up some of these angles and make the shots a little bit easier or a lot easier in some regards. But in saying that, you know, to shoot 20 under par like DJ did, I mean, that was some phenomenal play. Even the last day, that, you know, just what he was doing out there was just crazy. And he just was in total control of everything that he was doing. Some of the shots he hit under the pressure, patrons or no patrons, it was incredible. But I found the golf course and the experience to be something I'll never forget. I thought it was awesome. I'd love to see some of those stands move a little bit. And I'll be interested to see if they do anything like that. If they make any changes to some of the layout, maybe not the layout, but you know, where they position some of these stands, because I think that, you know, putting them up right by 15 green is a great example. If they move them back down the fairway a little bit, you kind of change some of the things about, or if you move it back further one way or the other. But I know that they want to keep things out of the camera lines as best possible, but yeah. I don't know. I think there might be different ways of doing it, but I thought that I think they'll learn something from having a patronless tournament and without all the stands and whatnot. I think they'll learn something from it.
There were some different camera angles that we saw as well, because the stands weren't there. One that springs to mind is the back of the ninth, whereas normally you're seeing that green sort of side profile. So drone shots that we saw, which were absolutely incredible. They were able to get drones in there because there weren't the fans. There was some, we all missed the fans, of course, but there were some awesome little bits that were done, which you wouldn't have been able to have if there were fans there. So it did have its...
The drones, actually, funny enough, were actually, they weren't, from what I understand, they weren't, the drones started off on site, but they weren't managed by anybody on site. It's actually done from an Air Force base in Augusta, not far away. So they actually controlled the drones from miles away at an Air Force base, from what I understand. And these drones, you could hear them, but they weren't distracting. So I think you're going to see the drones anyways. Mm-hmm. In the coming years out there, even without the patrons, but I could be wrong. I don't know if there's any liability there. I mean, there's always liability, right? Yeah. But these things were, Augusta's not going to do anything to put anybody in harm's way. So I think that, you know, these things are probably military grade, and they're flying around. They're going to do it right and make sure that these things aren't going to fall out of the sky. But from what I understand, these things were controlled by the Air Force base, which was a few miles away, which I thought was pretty cool. But yeah, they got some pretty sneaky things going on there in Augusta as far as military stuff goes. It's pretty interesting.
Probably a few members that know a bit of what's going on behind the scenes more than most people do.
I'm pretty sure that there's a lot of things that they have out at Augusta National that might be military grade. I'm speculating, but I'm thinking that might be a possibility.
Definitely a military grade wine cellar down there. That is of the highest order.
they definitely are not afraid to open up some wines that cost more than my car. Yes.
Just before we let you go and get back to your puppy, I'm sure he's wanting some attention. Are we going to be seeing you a lot on Sky Sports next year in 2021 as well?
You are. In fact, I just got off the phone last week with Jason Weston, my boss. I'm working 13 tournaments straight to begin in Palm Springs. So I'll be Palm Springs all the way through the RBC. Each and every week you're going to hear or see my ugly mug out there. So I got 13 in a row from there, and then I'll kind of taper it down to just some of the bigger events that we do. But we're going to do quite a bit on the front end, where since we don't have personnel that are coming over to the U.S. right now from the U.K., I'll be filling in those first 13 wigs. Then hopefully after that we can get some folks over here if COVID rules kind of relax a little bit. And depending on, you know, how the vaccines go and all that, I mean, I'm pretty sure they're going to get to the frontline workers, the politicians first and foremost. I mean, let's not forget them, but the politicians need them first, obviously, so they can make all the decisions. And then the frontline workers, and then the teachers and everybody. So I'm pretty sure that the guys that are doing Sky Sports Golf may not be in the top of that list, but you know, hopefully we'll get some guys over to the U.S. It'll be me for a little bit, and then I'm working 23 events next year for them, so I'm not going anywhere anytime soon.
Right. Are you playing any events as well?
I'll be playing some Champions Tour events. I'm not going to do a full schedule. I was kind of toying around with that idea, and then once COVID hit and I didn't get a chance to play that much as I was kind of hoping, expecting to in the fall. The tournaments I did play in, John, I don't know. It wasn't the same. It wasn't like going out there. I thought it was going to be a little bit more fun, a little more relaxed, but it really wasn't. And I'm not blaming that on anything. It just wasn't quite what I was hoping for and or expecting. So I'm probably not going to play as much as I was hoping to. I'm still going to play as much or quite a bit. I'm going to play in all the big tournaments. The one I'm looking forward to above and beyond all of it was playing in the Senior Open at Sunningdale. And right now I'm looking for a caddy. If you know anybody that's got that free week
John's hand straight up.
Well, I can't think of anybody better to go out there and have a hit and giggle with than John. So consider yourself hired.
John's in. He's on the bag.
John's in.
The Legend Tour is interesting for a bit more fun. I feel like the European Senior Tour is bouncing back in 2021 as the Legends Tour. And there always seems to be a good element of fun around that. Would you consider teeing it up at any of those events to see what that's like?
If it worked out with my Sky schedule, yeah. I mean, I'd have to have a reason, or I'd have to have, to fly over there for a few weeks at a time. You know, it's not super lucrative. And not saying that that's a huge deterrent, but for me, but for my wife, that's probably a deterrent. but you know, I would. In fact, I did take up my membership it's the Legends Tour.
Legends Tour.
Yeah, I did take up my membership on the Legends Tour. So if I do get the opportunity to play in a couple of events, I will. Unfortunately, right around the Senior Open, right after that, I think on the PGA Tour schedule is the Olympics, which unfortunately we're not covering. But then we got the WGC and then the playoff events. So to kind of go over there and string, that's not going to happen. But possibly the season-ending stuff. I mean, I've never been to Mauritius or the Seychelles, and I know that they have tournaments at the end of the year. Yeah, so I figure I can probably convince my wife to let us go over there.
That's an easy sell.
An easy sell. Yes, exactly. Yeah. But so I do have my membership there, and I'll play as much as I can. But the first year out or next year may not be a ton. But in looking past that, yeah, I mean, if I get the chance to get over there for the Senior Open and then go over there beforehand and whatnot, it just kind of depends on how the schedules lay out. But I would stay over there and play a few weeks if it made sense. And you're right, it's a little bit more fun on that tour, I'm sure.
Awesome to catch up with Rich there, direct from the US of A. Now, end of the episode, but one very important thing left to do. We've got our Motocaddy M7 Remote competition winner to announce. It's an incredible prize, thanks to our partners, Motocaddy. The M7 Remote retails for £999.99. It's the ultimate in hands-free electric trolleys, part of the award-winning M-Series range. It's got a slim fold system, making it possible to fit in the smallest car boots. Not only does it feature a rechargeable remote control handset, but other features include an anti-glare LCD screen, USB charging port, adjustable handle height, a pair of anti-skid rear wheels, and an extra removable anti-tip wheel at the back, so it's nice and stable on all terrains. The ergonomic remote control handset is extremely easy to use. You can switch it readily from the remote to a manual mode like a normal electric trolley. You've also got automatic downhill control, so it's not going to run away from you down any hills, emergency stop as well. It's an unbelievable electric trolley, the best one on the market. And one lucky person has got themselves an incredible, incredible Christmas present. John, you've got the name there. Who's winning that Motocaddy M7 remote electric trolley?
Just before I announce it, you're very, very lucky. It's a super duper trolley. I'm jealous. I wish I had one. I could do with it around my hilly track at Clevedon, that's for sure. But it's you, man, from Blackburn. Drum roll, everybody. Ridwan Umorji.
Well pronounced, John. Very well pronounced, I think. Ridwan Umorji, congratulations. Merry Christmas. You have got a Motocaddy M7 remote trolley coming your way. To everyone else, thank you so much for listening. Merry Christmas to you all if you listen to this before Crimbo. If it's just after, then have a great 2021. We've got one more episode coming up before the new year, so make sure you catch that. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Woo! Merry Christmas, everybody.